I mean, hospitality for me is showcasing a passion. It's about creating a positive culture and sharing that with the community. For us, it's about creating a community space. And obviously for us, it's also about showcasing coffee from around the world.
I love discovering new places to drink coffee anywhere in the world. You may recently have caught a podcast with me in Barcelona drinking coffee. But when I think about wonderful places in Melbourne where I've had great coffee experiences, Black Vice is certainly a place that comes to mind. It's in Hurstbridge. It's probably an hour from the centre of the city, a beautiful little suburb. And I remember sitting in Black Vice in the window. It's really picturesque. And I had a coffee flight. So three very different coffees from different origins, beautiful roasts, and prepared differently. So milk coffee, black coffee, it is all happening. The owner and founder of Black Vice is Lachlan Doherty. Lachlan's worked in coffee for a long time in Melbourne, but he reached out to me today. We're going to chat coffee, but we're also going to talk mental health. It is never a bad time to talk mental health. People in hospitality are always under pressure, and many people are feeling particularly under pressure at the moment. So Lachlan, welcome to Dirty Linen.
Thanks for having me, Danny. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's really great to have you on the show. For a start, just give us a little rundown on Black Vice. What do you guys do out there?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we're extremely passionate about coffee. Coffee is my kind of almost my entire life. I've done various things in hospitality, but essentially I've fallen into coffee and been doing it now for nearly 18 years. So now, you know, my partner Leah and I have opened Black Vice together, where we roast all of our own coffee. And it's sort of been a passion of ours to really showcase the best of not just coffee, but also hospitality. So we've worked really hard in putting together an amazing team, both front of house and back of house. And we, you know, have had the fortune of being able to attract some amazing chefs out to Hurstbridge. Our head chef nowadays, Eugene, was the sous chef at A Kettle Black before he came here. So, you know, we've really, I guess, tried to deliver something in Hurstbridge that wasn't really, I guess, available in the area previously. And that's sort of been the dream.
That's wonderful. So give us a sense of what Eugene's up to. What's a brunch dish that you reckon I should try next time I come in?
Well, I mean, Eugene is Malaysian background. And so I guess, you know, we've sort of really tried to encourage him to sort of, I guess, steer away from the typical path of what might be happening traditionally in Melbourne at the moment in the brunch scene, and rather, you know, sort of lean into some of those Malaysian roots. So, you know, we have like a bang bang chicken dish, which, you know, as the name suggests, is very spicy, but has a really beautiful sort of zesty twist to it. And the same goes, you know, we have a typical chili eggs, but again, it's sort of got that Malaysian twist to really kind of make it unique. And that sort of features heavily, I guess, throughout the menu. So, we are doing the classics, but we're also trying to, I guess, come up with ways to make them authentic to Eugene's history and background, and provide something that, isn't exactly what you expect it to be.
I love that. And what's a coffee that you're loving at the moment? I don't know whether it's a bean or a roast or a way of prepping it.
So for me, look, we work really closely with a farm in Colombia called Forest Coffee. I am absolutely in love with their coffees. It's owned by two young brothers, Shadi and Elias. They're probably two of the most entrepreneurial young men in the coffee world. They're one of the first farms that I know of in the world that have undertaken export of their own coffees entirely. So they export their own coffee into Europe, they export their own coffee into the United Arab Emirates, and they also now export all of their own coffee into Australia. So we're in a really fortunate position that we buy all of our coffee direct from them, straight from the farm, and they take care of the shipping, which is, you know, something that otherwise wouldn't be possible for us to have that direct trade relationship, because we simply don't use enough coffee to enter that realm ourselves. So having that relationship with these guys has been amazing. But doubly fortunately, these guys are very innovative. They are pushing pushing the boundaries, I guess, of coffee farming and also coffee processing. You know, last MICE, when we had the world championships at MICE, multiple of the largest coffee roasters in Melbourne showcased multiple of Elias and Chardy's coffees on their stand, showcasing a new processing method that they've recently innovated called Koji fermentation, which is sort of, I guess, a bit of a game changer in a lot of ways. But they have a lot of different coffees. And my personal favorite off their farm is the Geisha Marseille. It's a carbonic maceration Geisha. We've bought it off them 4 years in a row, and it's quite rare to get a coffee off a farm that tastes the same every year. But these guys literally are this good at what they do that they are producing year on year a coffee that tastes exactly the same, if not slightly better. And the Geisha Marseille is one of these coffees that when you have it with milk, it tastes like Neapolitan ice cream. And I say this to people and they look at me and they just don't believe me. They look confused. They think what I'm saying sounds a bit crazy. But when you drink it, and you can see it on people's face, when they drink it, they have like three stages of surprise. Because when you first take a sip, you get this really beautiful, sweet, intense strawberry sweetness. But straight away, you get this sort of rich chocolate, sort of heavy body undertone that comes through just after you experience that chocolatey berry sweetness, sorry. And then it sort of finishes up with this beautiful vanilla finish at the end, which is, I guess, a characteristic of the sweetness of the milk coming through. And this coffee, as I said, it sort of tastes the same every time, and you can kind of just watch people's faces as they experience this, and it sort of changes a lot of people's sort of perceptions of what coffee is, which is for me sort of the whole point of what we're doing here. And so when I give people that coffee, it really sort of sums up what we're doing.
Wow, you've really brought us into your world, Lachlan, and the passion, the depth of knowledge, those connections internationally that you've got. I think that's, you know, what a great rundown and a way to kick off this conversation. For people who aren't perhaps as embedded in the coffee world as Lachlan, when he says MICE, he's talking about the Melbourne International Coffee Expo. That is on this year in May, and check it out. It's a really great coffee showcase. People come from across the world to check out what's happening. So it's in May at the Convention Centre. So Lachlan, let's get to the meat of today's discussion, which is talking about the hospitality culture and the way that it can impact mental health. And we're going to, I guess, expand this conversation and talk about how mental health can affect people's businesses and the experience that customers have. Let's start by talking about the cultures and behaviours that you've witnessed over two decades in hospitality.
Yeah, so obviously, when I sat down to sort of think about how this conversation should go, I guess, the best way that I thought we could kind of work our way through this was to, I guess, sort of chronologically sort of tell my story of my experiences through hospitality. And it was kind of fascinating. I've always thought of myself as sort of a young member of the hospitality community who was sort of on my way up. And when I sat down and I put pen to paper and suddenly wrote 20 years ago when I got into hospitality, I realized maybe I'm not a young up-and-comer anymore. And it looks like I might be becoming a veteran of this industry. So I started 20 years ago as an apprentice chef, actually, at a restaurant that doesn't exist anymore. So I think I can probably tell you the name of it. It was called The Undertaker in Hawthorne. And it was a mammoth of a venue with an absolutely tiny kitchen. It was a four-story venue. It had a fine dining restaurant on the ground floor, cocktail lounge in the basement, bar on the first floor, and a private dining room for 60 on the second floor. And we had a kitchen that was big enough for about four chefs. It was nuts. It was crazy pressure. And I was there as a first-year apprentice. And within not very long of being there, I was running the entree section. I was running the dessert section. And my head chef at the time, he was under a lot of pressure. And it was this very, very typical, I guess, environment of hospitality back then. And unfortunately, I think still in some places, the general manager and the head chef hated each other. Absolutely hated each other. It was basically a constant battle between the kitchen and the front of house. And this was, a fairly toxic thing to witness, I guess, as basically a child working in this venue. And my chef's frustrations would often overflow onto me. And, you know, I would get abused, I would get yelled at. We actually had an elevator that ran between all the floors of this restaurant. So the only way that this functioned was the elevator went downstairs to one of the largest cool rooms you've ever seen, and a massive dry store with its own mezzanine. We had a bread room on the first floor. And that was sort of how we serviced everything. And we spent literally days prepping for the weekends. And whenever I made a mistake or whenever my head chef was angry at me, he would always very calmly walk to the elevator and press the button. And then when the elevator arrived, he'd be like, "Lachlan, come here, please." And we'd step inside the elevator and the doors would close, and I would get probably one of the biggest yellings at that I'd ever experienced. And sometimes if I was unlucky, he'd forget to leave his knife in the kitchen. And so instead of pointing at me with his finger, he'd point at me with his knife. Yeah, which was a lot to deal with as a 15, 16-year-old kid. And sort of that culminated in the day I resigned. I overcooked some pizzas and he threw a pair of tongs that hit me square in the face. And the crazy thing about that is I still stayed and finished service that day after being hit in the face with a pair of tongs. And I think back to that moment now and it still kind of chokes me up about the fact that I actually stuck around and endured that. But, you know, it was always done under the guise of, well, you know, my head chef was worse. So you should count yourself lucky. And so, you know, I left there and I kind of moved into coffee. And I worked my way up in the coffee industry until I eventually found a job at one of, at the time, the best coffee roasters in Melbourne. It was sort of like, you know, the first hipster warehouse conversion place to be, you know, roasting their own coffee. And, you know, everyone thought it was the coolest place and they had the best coffee around. But, you know, I took a pay cut to work there. I ended up working for $18.50 an hour. And we were open 365 days a year. We didn't get penalty rates. We were expected to work weekends. We were expected to work Christmas Day, New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, everything. $18.50 an hour, and that was it. And essentially, the motto there was, well, do you know how many resumes we have on our desk? If you don't like it, why don't you leave? And so that's the environment that I came up in. And I only sort of realized recently that I carried a lot of that with me. And unfortunately, I've, you know, although I was never, I think, that bad, we obviously in our venue pride ourselves on paying our staff correctly. But I think, you know, unfortunately, that same mentality that my head chef had towards me, I didn't unlearn it as quickly as I should have. And so I think when things got tough in our venue, I fell back into that trap of putting weight on my staff by telling them about how bad I had it and putting that in a lens that they should be appreciative of how good they have it. And I've sort of now really, you know, reflecting on that, have realized that it's really not fair for anyone, I guess, to put the pressures of their own past experiences onto their staff today. That's sort of, I guess, you know, really something I think that we as an industry, I think we're getting better at. But I think, unfortunately, there still is that prevalence of sort of an attitude of, do you know how bad I had it? You should consider yourself lucky. And I think that's something that really needs to change.
Wow. I mean, goodness me. For a start, I'm so sorry that you experienced that violence so early. You know, as you say, you were a child. And, to just, you know, feel that you had to just suck that up and get on with it, and that you were, I don't know, that you were supposed to be being mentored in that environment. But there was such savagery as a part of that. I mean, it is, yeah, like, how do you think that that's impacted your mental health? Like, how have you felt as you've come up through the industry and become a business owner as well?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, at the time, obviously, it weighed on me heavily. And I never really talked about it with anyone, I don't think. Like, I don't think I even really told my parents at the time. I think, you know, unfortunately, I kind of carried this idea that, you know, maybe this is what it takes to succeed. And looking back on it now, like, there are definitely positives to be taken away from that. Like, there are a lot of things that I did learn through that experience that I have definitely, you know, there are things that I, you know, I wouldn't say that anyone should go through that, but there's definitely things I learned through that, resilience, persistence and other traits, I guess, that I've carried with me from that experience that I definitely would say have helped me. But in general, like, I think I never really dealt with that. I haven't at all, because this is, I think, the first time I've publicly spoken about it, really, other than with friends. And so it's hard to, I think, really put into words maybe how that experience has carried with me. But obviously it definitely has affected aspects of my life going forwards. And that's, I think, up until this point, and that's sort of where I'm at right now, is I've sort of only now really realized sort of the traumas that I've been carrying without ever talking about them and thinking, you know, I'm not the sort of person who gets down about things. I'm not the sort of person who lets this affect me. And that, I guess, has been a naive mindset that I haven't really acknowledged or understood what I was actually carrying around with me.
And what was the turning point? I mean, what do you think has made this the time that you've opened up about it all?
Look, I think, you know, running a business now for 5 years, sort of the pressures of the business have weighed on me over time. Like, I definitely, you know, I've had, obviously not, I have not been unhappy and depressed for the last 20 years of my life. But I've had, you know, times where I've been as good as I ever have been. But I think that the pressures of running my business have slowly and meticulously eroded my mental health in ways that I didn't acknowledge and didn't deal with. And there were sort of so many things along the way, looking back on it, that sort of, you know, one little thing that, you know, led to another little thing. And it wasn't necessarily all one linear progression. I think it sort of ebbed and flowed, but by not dealing with things, it sort of eventually kept getting worse until eventually it sort of got to a point where it couldn't go any further unless I did something about it. And I think I sort of subconsciously started to realize that and slowly started to try and change things in my life. And have sort of now finally made changes, I guess, that have sort of started to come to fruition.
Let's talk about the changes in a bit, but what I'd love you to talk about first is the impacts that your mental state has had on your staff and your business, your customers as well.
Yeah, so look, when we first opened our business, my partner Leah and I together, like, the business was, I guess, us chasing a dream. We were, you know, definitely in a great place when we first started this business. We had a dream that we were going to open a place that was going to sort of change things. And, you know, historically I've worked in so many venues where the mindset was to do it as quickly and as cheaply as possible and try and make some money back. And when you finally make your money back, then maybe try and make it better. And I guess I was committed to not going down that path. I didn't want to open a venue that was just there for the sake of being there. And so fortunately, you know, I met my partner Leah, and we shared that dream, and she helped me with this. She basically funded our entire project, and for that I owe her everything we have. But we literally poured our entire soul and every cent we had in the world into this venue when we told ourselves we were going to do it differently. We were going to open a venue that was amazing from the start, and that was amazing. And when we first opened, the reaction was amazing and the energy was great and the culture was positive. But slowly, you know, we were naive. It was our first business that we'd ever opened, venue that we'd ever opened together. Before this, we'd only done events and festivals and things like that. And so, you know, we had a lot of great staff when we first opened, but we also had some staff that there were signs that we maybe shouldn't have hired them, but we were naive enough. And I think, you know, I sort of think of this as sort of like having a false prophet, you know, and I think it's a trap that a lot of small businesses fall into, is you hire a chef who cooks great food, but maybe they have abusive behaviors, or maybe they can't budget, or maybe they can't this, or maybe they can't that, but the food's great and the customers love it. And so you end up in this mindset where you believe that you need this person in your business, because if you let go of them, the food might not be as good. But as a result, the culture of your business is being eroded through this person's toxic behavior, and you start to look the other way because you believe that maybe you won't find a better chef. And so that's something I think we've really come to grips with over the years. And it's, you know, and it can be whether it's, you know, having a staff member who started off being really good and being a positive contributor to the business, but eventually maybe that contribution changes, and being able to then recognize that maybe it's the time for a staff member to move on. I think those are the sort of things that as a business owner you really need to stay on top of, because keeping someone around when they're no longer positively contributing to the business is more detrimental than being understaffed for a short period of time. And that's something I think we've only really come to understand properly recently. So I think, yeah, that sort of was where I guess we really started to lose some of our positive culture, was having people who may not have been looking after our interests in the business. And then we sort of fell into that same trap of what I talked about previously, of like the conflict between front of house and back of house, where you have a head chef and a manager that don't like each other. And then as the owner, you end up in the middle and you have two people who have different opinions and different directions who don't agree and constantly fight over it. And it's your job to basically mediate. And both of them are trying to pull you in different directions. And slowly as the owner, you don't necessarily know which one is right. And so you start second guessing yourself. You start not knowing which person is giving you good advice, which person is looking after themselves. And you kind of, I guess, start to enter a blur, as I would say, sort of, at least this is what it was for me. And I sort of started to second guess all of my decisions and start to second guess all of my thoughts and wonder if maybe, you know, this staff member who's saying that we should do the opposite to what I think we should do, maybe I'm the one who's wrong and maybe they're the one that's right. And this becomes a snowball effect over time. And as this is happening, I guess, you know, the business is starting to lose its direction and its leadership, because I've lost my direction and my leadership through not knowing, I guess, who or where I should be going. And there's multiple people trying to steer the ship all at the same time. And so that's sort of, I guess, where we ended up. And I think, you know, the way I would say is I feel like I fell asleep at the wheel. And the business kind of lost direction because of that. And I stopped making decisions and I stopped leading and I stopped directing. And we became, I guess, an anchorless ship sort of just floating around. And I think also, you know, partly probably ego and partly ignorance, we knew that we had great coffee and we knew that we had great food and we thought that that was enough, and we didn't sort of fully appreciate the importance of culture and direction. And it sort of took us a while, I think, to really grapple with the fact that it's not enough to just have great food or great coffee. People come for culture. They don't come for coffee. They want a friend. They want to chat. And they don't necessarily want to go to the best coffee shop in town if the mood is not good.
Wow, Lachlan, I mean, it's so powerful what you're saying. I feel like so many people are going to be listening to this and nodding, recognizing, you know, asking themselves some tough questions. And, you know, as a diner, it's really revelatory for me. You know, sometimes I'm in a business and, you know, it feels like you look around, you think this should feel good, but for some reason I feel awkward here. I don't feel settled in this space. There's something about being here that you know, that I don't want to experience again. So, you know, it's amazing that you've been able to recognize what was wrong in your business. I mean, it must be quite shattering though to realize that you've ended up in that place.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, we've essentially put ourselves in a position where we have a very big hole to dig ourselves out of. You know, like we sort of going through COVID, I think also, you know, being naive in our in business, I think, you know, we obviously, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that most of the people who own large cafe conglomerates or, you know, multiple venues, very few of them actually still own the first venue they ever started. And I think that for the most part, the first venue people start, and I guess this is why people take the path of going low cost, because you, generally speaking, have to make these mistakes in order to realize what to do right, or at least from a business perspective in terms of getting your taxes and your accounting and your COGS and everything else correct. It's sort of, you know, you either have to go do a degree in business or you have to learn on the ground. And if you start really big, the learning curve could cost you a lot of money. And that's sort of, I guess, what's happened to us. But, you know, I think that with that, we sort of, we feel like we now have an opportunity, I think, to start turning the ship. Unfortunately, it's a slow ship to turn. But we've really, I guess, noticed just in the last few weeks of sort of really starting to change the culture here, sort of bring in the right people, that the energy is changing. And I think people are seeing that.
Lachlan, I'd love other people listening to this to have get some ideas about what they might do to turn the ship around, you know, both personally and in their businesses. What have you done, you know, for yourself as a person, as a business owner, and for Black Vice?
I think the first starting point is being honest with yourself. It's recognizing that you have a problem. You know, it, for us, it's sort of obviously one of our biggest problems at the beginning was that we didn't acknowledge that we had a problem. You know, we had some of our best regular customers started not coming back. We had new businesses open in town that we felt weren't offering as good a quality products as we were. And so we sort of out of probably, we let our egos get in the way, and we were convinced that there's no way that this other venue could possibly take our customers. But if we were honest with ourselves, we would have said, well, they are taking our customers and there's something they're doing that we're not. And we would have had to have self-evaluated and tried to figure that out. But I think at that point, I was too depressed to sort of to self-reflect and realize what was happening. But, you know, along the way, when I look back on it now, I definitely think I knew that things were not right with me. And I needed to change those things. So, you know, almost a year ago, I started doing jiu-jitsu for the first time. I'd spent a lot of time in my life thinking that it's something I would like to do, but I never did. And so I think that was, for me, that was the first step in trying to make a change in my own life to try and sort of change my mental health. It wasn't quite enough at the time, but it was a step in the right direction. I think it was the first step in me doing something proactive to change my mindset. But it sort of snowballed and it got worse and it got worse, and it sort of, as I said, it sort of almost got to a point where I became almost catatonic, and it became abundantly obvious to me that something had to change. We were sort of almost at the point where we were convinced that we were going to probably let go of the venue and walk away, and probably do it for cents on the dollar, but it was killing us because we'd poured everything we had into this. And it wasn't what we wanted to do. And so, yeah, I went away and I went out and I had an experience. I went to a large festival, and it was something that I hadn't done since we opened the cafe. I used to go to festivals a lot. It was what we did for a living before we opened the cafe. And through that, when we were doing it previously, I had such an amazing community of friends that operate in that space. And so, yeah, I decided it was time to do something completely new that I hadn't done in a long time. And I went away and I went to a big festival and I reconnected with a lot of people that I hadn't seen in a really long time. And I danced a lot. I spent 5 days dancing and meeting friends, making new friends. And I guess for me, the way I would sort of explain it was kind of like a circuit breaker moment. It was kind of like going away and completely refreshing my mind. And it sounds simplistic, and maybe, you know, everyone's going to have their own version of that. But I think when you recognize that you don't know where to go anymore, you need to do something. You need to find a way to go and change what's happening inside your head. And I mean, you also need to talk about it. That's something I didn't really do at the time. And it probably would have really helped me from ending up where I was if I'd simply reached out and talked to people around me. But by that point, I guess I'd reached a stage where I just needed something. And so I went looking for it. And fortunately, I found it. And I came back reinvigorated with new energy and new ideas and positivity overflowing out of me. And then the first day I came back from the festival, I woke up at 3:30 in the morning. And I had all these amazing ideas going through my head. And I couldn't go back to sleep for ideas. And so I got up and I went for a 1-hour walk with my dog. And ever since then, I've gotten up every morning at 4 a.m. and I've gone for a walk with my dog. And it's been amazing. I think it's honestly the fundamental difference now in my life. It's sort of looking back on it, it's funny because I spent the last year saying I should get up and go running in the morning. It'd be good for me. I'll go to bed early or get up early and I'll go running. And I hate running. It's like, why would I want to go running? And this is how crazy my mindset was. It got to the point where I'd said, well, I don't own running shoes, so I can't go running. But maybe if I go buy a pair of running shoes, I'll get up and go running. So once I buy running shoes, I'll do it. And I still hate running, and I'm probably never going to go running. But I now get out of bed and I go for a walk in the morning. It gives me 1 hour of me time before the day starts. And I have amazing thoughts. It's basically meditative for me, I suppose. And it means that when I sort of start my day, you know, I get back to the house at 5 a.m. By the time I come into the cafe and I open the coffee bar at 6 a.m., I've been awake for 2 hours. I feel awake. I feel energized. I feel positive. And when the customers come in, they feed off that energy. Whereas previously I was in the same headspace that my customers were when they walked in. I'd gotten out of bed 30 minutes before the cafe opened, dragged myself down here in a hurry and tried to open as quickly as I could. So I really think that's, for me, that's been one of the biggest shifts, is sort of that change in behavior to really sort of give myself the time to work on me at least for an hour a day.
Yeah, that's amazing. And as you say, it would be different things for different people. But it's amazing that you found something that really has been a catalyst for you. I mean, tell me how that's helped you be a better leader for your team.
Yeah, so I mean, like, I guess, you know, it sounds so cliche, but like a positive mindset really does change everything. It changes the entire culture of the venue. Because of the behaviours, I guess, and because of the culture that happened here up until recently, we have had staff leave. Some of them, I guess, probably needed to leave. Some of them left because they didn't like what was happening. But it's sort of now given us the opportunity to start building our team again from the ground up. And we're being, I guess, a lot more thoughtful about how our team fits together. I think previously we would sort of take whoever we could get if they had the skill set. Whereas I think now we're sort of really thinking about how does our team work with the idea of operating with a positive mindset as a philosophy of business, not just something we hope to have on a occasional day. And this is something, you know, myself and our current floor manager have really sort of worked on together, is really agreeing, I guess, that positive vibes is not just an idea, it's what we do. Like, you can't choose to be happy all the time, but you can choose to put positive thoughts and vibes into a space. And so now, you know, we've agreed that we simply will work on each other. Everybody works together to help each other be positive. And if someone's not feeling it, I guess we try to encourage them to talk about it. We can, I guess, encourage each other to focus on positives and really just consciously remove negative vibes, remove negative thoughts from the venue. And that's not to say that we don't have issues that we need to deal with, but we agree to simply, you know, step aside, make the time and the space to go away and talk about issues that need to be dealt with and not have passing conversations on the bar or passing conversations at the pass about things that really don't need to affect the vibe of the venue. And so by, I guess, really making that the priority of how the team functions, we've essentially started creating a culture of positivity within the venue. And through creating a culture of positivity in the venue, the customers have started feeding off that. And they see it. They see that people are having fun here. They see that the staff all enjoy working together. It's like we get to now go to work and hang out with our mates, and it's like a little party. And the staff, the customers come in and they get to join our little work party for a moment, and they go away and they probably go to work and they think, oh, I wish I was at Black Vice enjoying the little coffee party that they have going on all day. And that sort of, I think, through building that culture, that's what leads to building a community.
I just feel so moved by everything you're saying, Lachlan. And, you know, I just love hospitality so much. I love these little ecosystems that have such profound ripple effects. And I just find it so moving that you, as a person, have been, you know, grappling and growing and, you know, hurting and finding solutions. Like it's so profound as a human what you're going through. And then to, you know, honor the lives of other humans around you, your staff and your customers, you know, the guys that grow the coffee, like it's so meaningful. It's so big. Like it just doesn't get bigger than what you're going through. Thank you for sharing it all with us. I mean, you're in a community at Black Vice, but you're part of a broader hospitality community. What would you like to see happen with the community more broadly? Like, should there be more community? Should there be more sharing?
I mean, look, it's really interesting that you asked me about that, because I think especially the cafe community, you know, I know everyone talks about that hospitality is hard, but I think that cafes honestly have it maybe one of the toughest areas of hospitality. And I think we've done it to ourselves. In a sense, we've almost, you know, and I think that, you know, a while ago, and this is something I've come to learn, I think, you know, you can do one of two things. You can focus on the negatives and it'll get you to where we are, or you can focus it on the positives. But there are drawbacks in the cafe industry for sure. We've sort of set up a paradigm where we've made it normal for customers to essentially expect close to fine dining service, but they expect it at a budget price. But they do also expect that the service is twice as fast. Like if you go into a restaurant and order a $90 steak, I did this the other night. My wife and I were going to a movie and we cut it fine. So we went in, we agreed no entrees, no desserts, glass of wine and a steak. And I said to them, oh, look, we're in a hurry to go to the movies. Please just, you know, ask the chefs if they can get this out as quick as possible. We're running late. We still waited 20 minutes for a steak. But that's normal, right? That's completely normal to pay $90 and wait 20 plus minutes to get it to your table. In a cafe, if a table waits 20 minutes for their food, they'll complain. And yet they're paying less than a third of the price. And it just doesn't really make any sense to me that we've ended up in this situation where we have to sort of do this. It seems, you know, I think everyone will reinvent and sort of innovate, and customers, I think, maybe will eventually start to realise that what the pressures that we put on ourselves are so difficult to actually meet those demands. But that's, I think that's where the cafe industry is at right now. And I also, like, think about that a lot, sort of the way that we, I guess, within the industry always chase approvals, and also, you know, personally, I guess a big pressure that's always constant for me is the idea of being judged. Obviously, you know, hospitality feels like a popularity contest. Everyone wants to write a review on Google. Everyone, you know, wants to let you know when you make a mistake. But, you know, you have the times as well where you get recognition and that makes it feel amazing. So, you know, the game, it's you know, looking for, obviously, getting a write-up in the Age Good Food Guide or getting a write-up in Broadsheet, which, shout out to Broadsheet, they still haven't written about us. So if you're listening, we'd love for you to come out and visit us. I don't think you know we exist, but hopefully you do now. but, you know, that pressure of sort of chasing approval, I think, is something that, for me, especially for cafes, I would love to see the Age Good Food Guide think about changing the way that they review cafes. Like, restaurants can get hats, but cafes can't. And it doesn't make sense to me. Restaurants get hats because they serve dinner or they're open at night. But cafes can't have a hat because they're not open at night. I don't know why that is. It doesn't make sense to me that there's a system to honour restaurants. But if we're lucky as a cafe, we could make the top 20 once a year. That's what I want to see change, to be honest.
Wow. We literally had a meeting about this yesterday. So this is very timely. Because, yeah, look, it's a conundrum. I mean, hats have historically meant a certain thing. I think there's definitely a desire to acknowledge, you know, the brilliance of cafes because they're where people live, you know, they're at the heart of people's lives. But yeah, I don't think we have a perfect metric to recognize that. So I hear you.
and that is not a criticism of the Age Good Food Guide. I love what you guys do. I just think that there is the realms, you know, it doesn't have to be hats. It could be coffee cups. It could be come up. We could, as long as I think it's something where cafes are working so hard right now to be perfect, and there are so many cafes doing such amazing things, but the top 20 sort of, you know, it's a bit of a musical chair. It's, you know, there's a small number. It's getting much better, I think. Years ago, it was always the same 10, 12, 13 cafes would make the top 20 list of every list. And there'd be maybe one or two newcomers who would make that list. And fortunately, I think those big players are starting to be less prominent on those lists and smaller, more innovative businesses are starting to be more prominent on that list. But I definitely think that for cafe owners, it would make such a difference to their mentality if they were able to achieve some recognition of quality that is permanent and they keep it, unless they get worse, and they can do better if they improve. That, I think, is what's missing from the cafe industry, is that level of progression in recognition of quality that restaurants have, and we don't have that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. So I'll definitely feed this back to the team at Good Food. Lachlan, I feel like we've covered so much today. I'd love you just to finish by talking about what hospitality means to you.
Yeah, look, I mean, hospitality for me is showcasing a passion. It's about creating a positive culture and sharing that with the community. For us, it's about creating a community space. And obviously for us, it's also about showcasing coffee from around the world. You know, like, I've sort of had the inspiration this week that I've reached out to one of my favourite coffee farmers. Traditionally, there's always been this sort of idea within the coffee industry that I know of that there have been a number of coffee roasters that have had partnerships with coffee farms, but those coffee farms have always been, that partnership has always existed at origin. So I've sort of reached out to one of my favourite coffee farmers this week, actually, and suggested that we could start a partnership. But instead of the partnership existing at their farm, that partnership could exist here in Australia at our cafe. And it's sort of, for me, it's about trying to rethink how we can do things and how we can sort of showcase what some of the world's best producers on the other side of the planet are doing, but do it in a way where they actively are involved here in Australia and through our cafe, and getting to share that with the community and getting those farmers involved at this end in sharing what they're doing with the community. Because I think having them recognised for what they're doing and acknowledged is sort of really the core to what we do. All we do is really showcase what someone else on the other side of the planet is doing. I simply honour someone else's hard work by roasting the coffee, really. It's my job not to make the coffee something, but to simply not damage what the farmer has already put into it. And sharing that with people is what, I guess, is at the heart of everything we do here.
Wow, it's beautiful. Lachlan, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I feel like this chat is going to resonate with so many people. I really appreciate your honesty, your vulnerability, and your recognition that there were things in yourself and around you that you wanted to change. Like, all power to you, and thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me, Danny. One last thing while I've got you here. It's one tiny little shameless shout out. We are actually looking for a new general manager. So if anyone listening to this podcast would love to come and help us build our dream, please feel free to reach out to us.
Thank you, Lachlan. Really appreciate your time.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me, Danny.
This is Dirty Linen and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you.